really, the public schools are the main road to the arts in our society, or they have been at any rate. Did you get into music through school? Or?
Absolutely. Yeah. Played in the band, sang in my church choir, but, you know, played in the band and knew that I wanted to be a musician. I mean, I thought about other things, but, and sometimes wish I had done other things, you know, but I, somehow, you play an instrument and you play it well enough and you have a passion for music and it's really, all you want to do is listen to music and look at music, you kind of think, well, I might know how to do this. And you end up at music school and you find out you really don't know how to do it, but then you know, they try to help you.
And what's your instrument?
I was a French hornist.
Tough instrument.
And I mean, that's how I showed up to undergraduate school. And then, but I was composing when I was in high school and really changed over as an undergraduate to be a composition major, and how I ended up at Brandeis because they had a wonderful composition department as a graduate school. And then all that time I was also starting to conduct a little bit. So it was sort of a long evolution.
Who did you study with at Brandeis?
I studied with Arthur Berger and Harold Shapiro, Seymour Schifrin. He passed away while I was a student. And Martin Boykin. Those were the composers who, very influential. In fact, I don't compose anymore. I would say that they had a profound effect not on my music, because I'm not sure that I was ever destined to be a composer. I think I was more in love with the idea of composing than in love with composing. But they had incredible influence on how I look at music and how I think about music and actually how I feel music. Each one in his own way. And at Oberlin, I think that the people who were most influential affected the way I think about music more than saying, well, that horn teacher, he taught me so much about playing the horn. You know, I think, no, well, there was that eurythmics teacher and chamber music coach and just all-around musician who probably touched my life much more profoundly than anyone else did. And I never heard her make a sound except at the keyboard a little bit, in a keyboard harmony class. And so you never know who's going to turn you around in some way or another. But I think the way, the things that I think have been most profoundly affecting in my musical life in terms of schooling are people who were not teaching me to be a conductor or teaching me to be a horn player or a composer, but teaching me to be a musician. And then you figure out how to apply that to whatever it is you're doing. So I'm sure there are analogs, you know, in the visual arts, and maybe that person who really opened your eyes to a particular era or painter or trend that just had never been open to you at all.
Yeah.
You know, your heart hadn't been open, your eyes hadn't been open, it sort of like peeled it away, and now you could see.
Mm-hmm. So. That's great. So what brought you to Boston?
Well, I came to Boston to be a graduate student at Brandeis.
Oh, Brandeis,
yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
And I left for a few years because I was drafted, and I auditioned for and got into one of the Washington service bands, played in that for a few years, and then got out, and then came back to graduate school. But by the time I came back, I was really probably, you know, the test for me, when I left Brandeis, having been here for a semester, I thought, well, this is great. I understand that this job in Washington is not so time consuming. So I won't resist emotionally the idea of going and giving over 3 or 4 years. It was supposed to be 4 years. It was a 4-year commitment. Because I'll have time to compose. And that's something I haven't had as a student. So now I'll be able to really do my own work. And 3 years passed, 3.5 years passed, and I hadn't written. And that told me that I really wasn't going to be a composer. And instead, I had always treated the horn, even though I had started out as a horn major, I'd stopped being a horn major as an undergraduate, and so I sort of had treated the horn rather casually, and I kept playing, and I played, but I didn't practice very much. And somehow, playing every day, as I had to do in Washington, got me interested in the sort of physical act of playing and the sort of physical enjoyment of that. Whether I liked the music we were playing or not was almost irrelevant. I didn't. And so I came back and I was more interested in playing than composing, but I was at Brandeis. I was in a graduate PhD program. And so I kept studying. I kept writing but I started playing more and started conducting more. And gradually took the orchestra conductor decided to take a year's leave or something, asked me if I wanted to do it, and I did, and then he didn't come back. He came on back on the faculty, but turned the orchestra over to me, and I went on to the faculty there and taught theory and stuff like that for a while, but long about that, somewhere in there, then I became music director of Cantata Singers. I ended up sort of having to give up the horn. It's too, as you said, it's a tough instrument. It's a time-consuming instrument. All of them are. But for me, there wasn't a way for me to play at a sort of maintenance level. And maintenance itself was enormous. The commitment, the time commitment for maintenance was a lot. I don't know whether that's true of every instrument, but it certainly was true of the horn, for me anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you're preparing performances today, does your background as a composer come into play? Oh. Are you thinking about how it's constructed?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I teach conducting now at BU, and I've gotten to saying to prospective students, this could be an interesting program for you if you are really interested in looking at music. If you're interested in thinking about how music goes, how music breathes, how it unfolds, what the composer's thinking about. And if, on the other hand, you're interested in conducting, is standing on the podium and inspiring people and leading people, and then this is probably not the program for you. We're going to talk about this stuff. We will deal with those things, but it's really not where I come from. And it would be frustrating for you to come and for you to expect us to focus simply on conducting technique, that physical, the waving, what I call the waving part of mm-hmm. conducting, which is such a minuscule part of it. And inevitably, we spend a lot of time talking about that. But the thing that's interesting is trying to get into the musical minds of these composers and their hearts, trying to understand the musical language of that particular composer and what makes the phrase breathe, what makes it work, what makes it unfold, what it is that we have to do as the performers to help it breathe, help it come to life, and I think that's our job. And it's our job whether we're the violinist or the singer or the conductor. It's just the tools are slightly different. And the violinist and the singer are making noises. So they have kind of an immediate feedback as to whether what they're doing is a reflection of what's on the page. And the conductor doesn't have that. It's a little more enigmatic. Obviously it's enigmatic. People talk about wonderful violinists, and what's the first thing they say? They say, oh, it's a wonderful tone, or so expressive, and sort of those kind of generalities. What is the first thing they say about a conductor? Oh, he's so charismatic. Well, that charismatic, I mean, politicians could be charismatic, or bankers can be charismatic, and anyone can be charismatic. And it's just that charisma is, or lack thereof, is the, for the, what I would call the innocent observer, is the most obvious characteristic that one can attach to a conductor.
And his manner and bearing.
Yeah, the manner and the bearing. And you respond to that physicality, and you have an immediate reaction to, well, you have an immediate reaction to the pianist who's coming out on the stage, and he hobbles out on the stage, and he looks frail, and he kind of bows half-heartedly, and you think, who is this guy? I don't know. Can he play? And he sits down and he plays up a storm. And that impression you had of him hobbling on the stage is erased somehow or supplanted by the reality of what he's doing. The conductor hobbles out on the stage and he doesn't look very authoritative, or he looks too authoritative or something. And you have a reaction to that. And he gets on the podium and you continue to have a reaction to that. Because it's not clear what the conductor's doing. It's not exactly, it's not precise. It doesn't mean that it's smoke and mirrors. I don't believe that at all. But when we look at, say, Los Angeles Philharmonic, and they're hiring a very gifted 28-year-old music director, and now they're starting to say, the reviews are starting to say, well, he might be a very good musician.
Mm-hmm.
That was a thoughtful performance. That, they're talking about the music making. But this, it's a little late to be talking about, and I hope that proves to be the case,
Yeah,
but it's a little bit late to be talking about that after having hired as a music director for, one of the principal orchestras in the United States. I'm not saying they didn't think about it at all. But it's not people's first focus. The first focus is, did he excite the orchestra? Did he excite the audience? And that's not necessarily thinking about the music.
Of course, the boards of these orchestras are really keen to get people in, so they've publicized the hell out of Dudamel coming to L.A., and now we have Alan Gilbert in New York, and that's been very well prepared. And it's interesting in Alan Gilbert's case, because he was really not well known in America. Dudamel, at least, was touring with the Simon Bolivar Youth Orchestra, and he conducted the BSO.
Sure.
And I'd heard him at Tanglewood the first time, and he was just there. I hadn't heard any hype about him or whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And good concert.
Yeah.
I've heard other good concerts there, too. But
well, I had someone say to me yesterday, I did a performance yesterday afternoon, short performance. And I came off, and an art historian was at the concert. And she said, very nice, very good job, wonderful. I hadn't met her before, so it was not a continuing conversation. It was the first conversation. It was very brief. She said, I always look at the conductor. And I'm not sure what she was saying to me. I wasn't quite sure. And my reaction was, you should listen. listen first. Mm-hmm. And I hope I found some polite way to say that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not sure it was polite. I don't know. And she said, oh, yes, I listened to you. You know, but listening is a secondary activity for a lot of people when they go to an orchestra concert. And it's a confusing thing to people. And I think it's confusing because you look at, you know, Seiji Ozawa, extraordinarily gifted conductor, no more physically gifted conductor do I know of. And then you look at James Levine, just to take two successive music directors of the BSO, you know, as examples, and not terribly interested in the specifics of that physical act of conducting, and I think a charismatic person, but not necessarily a charismatic conductor in the gestures and the demeanor on stage, those kinds of things. And it's difficult for people to sort those things out.
He tries different techniques. I heard him interviewed once about conducting in general, and he has this circular movement he uses in triple time, and he was explaining that it looked extremely vague, but a French conductor had taught it to him, and he found that he could contract and expand his gesture as a dynamic communication.
Yeah.
And that made it easy for him. It was a shorthand.
Yeah. I mean, by no means am I saying that Mr. Levine doesn't think about conducting as a technique of some sort. I'm just saying that I think that I can't think of two conductors who look more different than those two.
Absolutely, and you can hardly say Levine is physically gifted with all the physical problems he's had. And he's tried these odd different techniques. He started out using just minimal gestures, and the orchestra didn't like that, and so now he's...
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, you've talked to them probably,
and
I think some of that minimalist conducting that he did at first was making art out of necessity. You know, I think his health was not so great, and just the exertion was difficult. But there was also method to that madness, and it was very helpful method. And that was that they had a music director who was so gifted that he basically could show anything. And I think to some degree the orchestra began to depend upon that. I think they really did depend upon that. And commensurate with that came a diminished sense of the orchestra as a huge chamber ensemble in which people listen to each other, communicate with each other, and that everything was, in a sense, coming through the conductor, good, bad, or indifferent. And I know that Mr. Ozawa would say, listen, you know, he would implore that they listen, but because he was so specific with his physical gestures, it allowed people really not to listen to the degree that I think orchestras can and should, especially if you are in as wonderful a concert hall as Symphony Hall, one in which the players really can hear themselves. I mean, they can hear each other rather well. There are halls where that's not possible. You know, Kennedy Center is a difficult hall. And so I think Mr. Levine perhaps said, I need to wean this orchestra from depending... I've never heard him say this, and this is only my theory, that he said, I need to wean this orchestra from an over-dependence upon the physical actions of the conductor. And I'm just not going to give it to them. We need to become a chamber group again. All the time. And he was, you know, it did. You're right. It drove the players crazy. It frustrated them. And yet the level of the playing, there were scary moments. I think scary moments. And I know the principal bass player said to me that, you know, Mr. Levine was conducting some Elliot Carter piece with a big score, a huge score, and the basses were on stage right, on the conductor's left. And Mr. Levine loves music. He's really interested in music. He likes looking at music. He turned the page for in the middle of the score, halfway, and got interested in something on the page, did not complete, but kept conducting, did not complete turning the page, and therefore this tiny beat that he was giving the orchestra was completely invisible to anyone on that side of the orchestra, on stage right. You know, so, you know, they really had to really increase their reliance on each other. And then, yes, you're right, I think the players said, oh, Mr. Levine, please, can you conduct larger? And he started to conduct larger. But, and that may have been coincident with, you know, improved health, but also it may have been now okay to conduct larger because, you know, he had weaned them in some way.
Now, teaching and training is a big part of his way of thinking, I gather.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's what conductors are, and orchestras don't necessarily want to be taught because they are very highly trained musicians themselves with, you know, years of education, the theory and history and all of that, and knowledge, and they don't necessarily want to be taught in an obvious way.
Do you go to symphony regularly yourself?
I don't go regularly, but it's sort of a liability of being a professional musician.
You know, you're busy. Yeah.
Well, it's not just busy. I go to concerts, my colleagues, students, things that I think I need to go to because are directly related to my work, and I try to go to symphony when I can or any number of the hundreds of musical performances that go on in Boston area that are extraordinarily high level all the time in the city. And it's one of the marvels of Boston is that it's not a one-horse town. It's not a town with a symphony orchestra and then a few things. No, it's a city with a fleshed out, fully thriving professional musical scene that is at a very high level, of which the Boston Symphony Orchestra is a very important part.